Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome one and all to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. As always, I'm your host, Mitch Michaels from the Santa Monica Studios, and we've got a great show here for you this week, discussing the game you know and love just days away from the start of the Australian Open. Up first, I chat with Mark Knowles, the former world number one in doubles, a mainstay on the Tennis Channel airwaves, and one of the most knowledgeable people in all of tennis. We break down all the lead-up action to the Australian Open, Rafael Nadal's injury, what that means, that there will be no Rafa at the Australian Open, if there's any worry with Novak Djokovic's wrist as he looks to win yet another title down under, Iga Swiatek at the top of the women's game, Grigor Dimitrov and Andre Rublev get titles, what to expect from the Americans. We have a lot to break down with Mark Knowles. And then it's Coco Vandeweghe for an in-person sit-down where we cover a lot of ground. Vandeweghe recently retired last fall. She discusses her decision to call her career quits, being honored at the U.S. Open, playing doubles in her final event in San Diego with Danielle Collins, striking up a friendship there. Her pride in her country, playing for Team USA in the Fed Cup, now Billie Jean King Cup, and what that meant to her. And her transition to commentary and how she's become a natural on the mic and is not afraid to share her thoughts, gaining some new skills. We talk about her getting back into skiing after time apart, some sage advice from Bill Walton. There's a lot discussed with Coco Vandeweghe. Two outstanding guests on this week's show, former tennis players, commentators, Olympians. They love golfing, a lot in common, a lot to discuss with Mark Knowles and Coco Vandeweghe on Tennis Channel Inside In. Let's start the show. All right, now joining us on Tennis Channel Inside In. First appearance of the new year. I can see he's rocking the Georgia Tech gear as a proud father. But Mark Knowles in the studio to discuss all the lead-up events to the Australian Open. Mark, welcome back to the podcast. It is quite the time to be a tennis fan or a sports fan in general.
Yeah, it's always exciting, right? The new year, a lot on the horizon, especially in the game of tennis. Men's side, women's side, you know, obviously we're super excited to have Rafa back. Unfortunate news, obviously, for him to get hurt, but there's still tons of storylines on the men's side. Will Novak continue to dominate? That's the question we always ask. Or will there be a new challenger? And then on the women's side, obviously, lots of great storylines.
Yeah, I guess we should get up with the somber news first. No Rafa at the Australian Open. We were all excited for the comeback. He looked great in the first two matches. He plays Jordan Thompson, loses, has match points. Was getting checked out, says after the fact that he had a micro tear on the muscle in that surgically repaired hip, pulls out of the Australian Open, says he's going back to Spain for treatment, for rest. It's gutting for a lot of reasons. He just said point blank, Mark, that he's not ready for best of five tennis. You have to ask, though, will he be and what's that going to look like? What was your reaction to not just the injury on court, but the decision of him to skip this Aussie summer?
Yeah, honestly, I was completely bummed. You know, I think we all missed Rafa when he was away. Obviously, one of the all-time greats. Such a unique style, such a great person, right, on and off the court. And I think the reason I was really bummed was I was a little bit surprised at how well he was playing. You know, Rafa's normally one of those players, as great as he is, he needs a couple of matches, needs to play his way in. But it shows that he put in the work in the offseason, felt like his body was healthy. But, you know, having been a player and knowing the rigors of the sport, you just can't duplicate, you know, tension, matches. And, you know, that's going to be the tough one for Rafa, right? Is kind of towing that line, navigating how many matches does he need and, you know, how often can he play? Especially when you think about, obviously, his specialty being the clay. A little bit more rigorous. Of course, he's adept, about as adept on that surface as anybody in the history of the game. But still, it's demanding physically, especially at the French where it's 3 out of 5 sets. So, you know, we can only hope for the best. I mean, the good news about Rafa, he's incredibly resilient. Unfortunately, he's had to deal with just, you know, an outlandish number of injuries throughout his career. You know, I think also the other thing it highlights, you know, I was talking to a buddy yesterday. I was actually talking to Marty Fish and, you know, Novak Djokovic, right? I mean, that's how, you know, when you see Rafa get hurt, like that's normal at his age.
Yeah.
You know, and Novak's continuing to defy everything health-wise on the court, and you just sit back and marvel, really.
Yeah. It was jarring for Nadal for a couple reasons. One, you said he put so much work in. He has done this before where he's taken time off, he's been injured, comes back, and then he looks like the guy. For him not to look like it, for him to look, you know, as you said, an expected thing of old age and wear and tear, was jarring to see. I was thinking about this too, Mark. Like, he deserves a proper send-off as much as anyone, but that's not how sports work. Like, it's very rare that we get those fairy tale endings. What's more likely in a lot of cases is this, an aging guy who's doing all he can, putting the hours in, but life's not fair and sports aren't fair.
Yeah, it's really tough, right? Everybody wants to write their ending. Obviously, we've seen all the all-time greats throughout all the sports have different types of endings. You know, in tennis, Pistol Pete obviously wrote the great story. You know, but the problem is if you win your last one, you think, wait, are there more, right?
So and he was 30, right? Yeah. I mean, that's, we're talking about 37-year-olds, the guys out here, yeah.
You know, we saw today one of the legendary coaches in all of sport, Nick Saban, possibly retiring. You know, he would have preferred to win a national championship, I'm sure, on the way out. But as you said, you can't write your script. You can try your best. And, you know, but one thing you know about Rafa, he does it the right way, right? He's not going to play unless he feels he's fit and ready. You know, one of the greatest professionals as far as the way he attacks his approach. You know, let's hope. I mean, I think we're all cheering for Rafa, right? I mean, in a perfect world, if we could if we could write the scenario for him, it would be, you know, obviously win Roland Garros and maybe, you know, go off and spend time with your family. Yeah. But it's hard because he's like a lot of great champs. He loves the sport, right? And it's hard. It's hard to say goodbye.
Paris Olympics too, right? We don't know what the next step's going to be, when he's going to play again. We hope that he can just, you know, have fun and enjoy it and compete at a high level, but we're just going to have to wait and see. It's going to be the first Aussie Open since 99 without Federer and Nadal in the draw.
Crazy.
It's just, that's crazy. A quarter century. And it signifies the changing of the eras. Djokovic is still around, though, still at a high level. And it is a familiar scene, right, too. I talked about it last week on this show with Jason Goodall. He's coming in a little banged up. There is the wrist situation. He's not going to minimize what that situation is, but he does have to manage where we are in this schedule and where he is in the tournament. But as I said last week, there's nobody better at managing their body and knowing what you have to do week in, week out, match in, match out. So I expect more of the same. I would say, Mark, my prediction going forward before that we get the official draw is that Novak will raise his level each match. So don't expect best Novak Djokovic in match one. That's saved for finals.
You know, it starts with the question, is he banged up?
Oh, right? There's
always that question mark.
That's true.
And he is obviously, you know, one of the all-time greats in any sport, one of the all-time great athletes. I mean, you know, it's coming to the point where it's automatic, right? Like, I mean, at some point, it has to stop, but maybe not, right? Because he's surely denying it. But, you know, I think Novak is so measured in his approach. I think it helps him to have a little something. I mean, we've seen a couple majors the last couple of years in Australia. He's had some issues, right, between the stomach, I think the hammy, now the wrist. But he's as good as anyone. I mean, he's a guy that donate. I mean, we were talking about this yesterday once again. I mean, everything he does in his life is geared towards being 100% fit mentally and physically when he takes to the court.
Yeah.
So just think about that, right? We've seen some great athletes in other sports, but I think Novak has taken it maybe to an extremist level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he deserves everything he gets because he's putting in the work on and off. Every single thing he does has a purpose. And so one thing you know about Novak, let's hope that he's 100% healthy, but the good news is he responds better than most. He handles adversity better than most. If he's got a goal in mind, if he feels that there's something working against him, it empowers him even more. So I'm no fool. I'm not betting against Novak.
There's never been a slippage. Like, you win, you think complacency enters the brain. It's human nature, even with his age. But no, he works just as hard, starts the process over. And also, if he wins this Australian Open, we know Rafa Nadal's French Open tally of 14, but that would be 11 for this single tournament. So it would be in the same neighborhood, not the same level, but It's just startling stuff. So we'll see what happens with Novak. I did want to get to some of the other stuff to give props to what we've seen in the lead up. And Mark, it starts with a blast from the past, playing his best tennis in at least 7 years. Grigor Dimitrov wins a title. He wins in Brisbane, first title since the ATP Finals in 2017. And who he beat and how he beat him. He beats Holger Rune in a classic match, a high-level match. And Grigor, it's something to see him play at this level because he's answering a lot of questions that people have had about him. And again, proving that in your 30s, you can play some of your best tennis.
Yeah, hard to be happier for a player than Grigor, right? He's a guy that does it the right way. He works as hard as anybody. He's always been one of the fittest players. Tremendous guy off the court. He's never changed, whether he's top 10, whether he's winning ATP Tour Finals, whether he's going through a drought, as he just did. He's the same guy day in, day out. So I think we all marvel at his game. We know the talent that he possesses, the athletic ability. I mean, that guy, put him on a short list.
Very
as
short.
One of the best athletes to go out on a tennis court. So to see him playing that way, who knows? He's probably got a renewed purpose, right? Maybe some pressure's been alleviated. We've always known he's had the game, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it also speaks volumes when you see the drought. It was even hard for me. I was like, really?
Yeah.
It's been that long?
Yeah.
Like, he's way too good. But what it speaks volumes for is that's how hard it is to win on tour.
It is.
Right? That's how hard it is to win on tour. So let's not lose sight of that. The good news is he's playing great tennis. And he's a player that would obviously have the belief, even though he's never, lifted a trophy at a major. He's been deep in majors before. And he's somebody that would say, hey, well, why not me? So super exciting to see.
He was building towards this moment, played great down the stretch last year. And the one thing with majors, I know he's never done it, but you do not have to question fitness with him. This is one of the fittest guys. So that's a question you ask about a lot of players, but not him. Quickly on Holger, no one ever wants to lose, especially in a final. But these are the lessons to learn that I think aren't bad. Like, he played a good match, could have been a little better, was right there. We're starting the season. And again, no fitness issues for him. So Holger, it's much of the same. We know what the potential is, but you can't win every match.
Yeah, it's a great week, right? I mean, we always talk about what's the ideal prep heading into the year's first major. Getting the finals, getting a couple matches under your belt, that's the perfect prep, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, he would have liked to have won that final. But as you said, no shame in the way he played, no shame in the way he competed. Key thing for him, obviously, is experience, right? He's got more experience now under his belt. He's kind of a big energy guy, right? So you got to manage that in 3 out of 5 in majors. Probably something that he's learning. Obviously, great additions in his camp. We've got the legendary Boris Becker. Also got Severin Luthi in there as well. So he's got the group around him that can really help him navigate. There's more to playing tennis at a major, right? It's how to deal with the off court. It's how to train. It's how to recover.
Right.
And he's got the team around him. So it could be a special year for him.
It's going to be fascinating to see the different approaches and how it pans out success-wise. The players that played these tournaments, we saw Andrei Rublev win in Hong Kong, United Cup, which is a little different than players like Sinner, Alcaraz, and Medvedev, who have not or will not be playing before Aussie. So I don't know if you have a preference or it is a case-by-case basis, but I'm just going to be following and seeing if there is a trend, like which players did a little better.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and being around the tennis world for a number of years, I think the ideal prep, right, is to play 2 weeks before the Aussie and hopefully win, get to the final, get that week off, get to, maybe take 2 days off after the final, get to Melbourne, get a couple of practices in on the show courts. If you're maybe a little lower rank, hit with some of the top guys. That's probably the ideal preparation, right? You don't want to be playing necessarily all the way up until Saturday, but also it gives you confidence, so you never know.
Yeah, that extra day, too, is going to be fascinating. And for Rublev, I just wanted to mention, I watched that match against Rusevori. It was pretty exciting. There's just nobody like him. It's like he's like a boxer that stands firm and isn't going to give an inch. Like, he just stands and crushes ground strokes. He's never going to back up. He doesn't really come to the net that much, but when he's firing, especially forehands on the baseline, it's a marvel to see.
He's fascinating because he's kind of an enigma, right? Because the way he plays, you think boxer, ferocity, Tyson, like get in the ring and we're going to swing. Yeah. And then you look at his approach off the court.
Yeah.
Couldn't be nicer. Couldn't be more thoughtful, right? So it's a tale of two worlds. So how can you not cheer for Rublev?
Tale of two Rublevs. I like it.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
More with Mark Knowles here on Tennis Channel Inside In. I have to bring up the United Cup because that final was high drama. Germany over Poland. Alexander Zverev down the stretch saves match points in the singles, must win against Hubie Hurkacz. Then they win that epic mixed doubles match, him and Laura Siegemann against Iga and Hurkacz. So for Zverev, it's digging deep. For this event, it was high drama at the end. You had the world's best women's player, and Iga Swiatek, look flawless too. So this was a job well done, and props to Zverev and Team Germany.
Yeah, United Cup, you know, it's always interesting, right? You always hear the players talk about team competition so special. And I think the United Cup did a great job because it was very competitive as well. And, you know, Sasha Zverev, he's one of those guys. He's been the forgotten man, right, since he got injured at the French. But he's starting to round back in form. And you know he's got a good record, reasonably good record compared to anyone else against Novak. So he's a guy you got to keep an eye on. And on the women's side, like you said, Iga just continuing to look great, right? And she's only getting better week by week. And she's somebody that's kind of embraced being the number one player in the world and just kind of really having tunnel vision on her game, not getting too caught up in the rankings, the results, and you know, realizing that the better she plays, the more matches she's going to win.
I don't know how I feel about MVP, though, on a losing team. Like, that was a little, you know, it's like the Jerry West finals for the Lakers, that Cowboys. But again, like, all things, you know.
The outstanding player.
Yeah, and she was. But MVP, I don't know. But look, you're exactly right. She is the favorite to win the Australian by a considerable margin, and it speaks to one thing. Her consistency at a match-by-match level can't be matched. Now, we're going to get to the other finals and players that are in the mix, but no one has her consistency, and that's what you need to win seven matches in a row. And that speaks to who Iga is and how she approaches tennis on a day-to-day basis. Having said that, you know, Rybakina over Sabalenka is the one I want to get to because I said last week, like, Rybakina was the forgotten woman of the big three, big four there.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't have the year she would have liked, still was number four. You know, still had a couple big titles. And that win over Sabalenka, and I know Sabalenka can go up and down, but that was mightily impressive by someone that just has that low pulse, keeps in the match. And Elena Rybakina, I think, will have a big 2024.
Well, there's no doubt that Rybakina has the game. And more importantly, when you think about matching up against Iga, she's got the firepower, right? So the key component, as we've talked about, is consistency. So if she can get, and that's not just on the court, that's more mentally, right? To be number one in the world, to be consistent week in, week out, that's a completely different mental approach. So that would be my only question for Rybakina as far as game. This could be the year, right? This could be the year if she starts off well and realizes, you know what, I'm going to take over that mantle because I've got the weapons, I've got the ability. You know, the tough question is always the mental side of it, and that's where Iga kind of has a leg up on everyone else.
For sure. Big wins, though, over. And I know I don't want to read too much into the first tournament, rounding into form and all that, but she can say what very few, if anybody else, can say. I've got big wins over Sabalenka and Iga, and that's mightily impressive. Yeah. I also have to be impressed. I know it wasn't as stark in competition match to match, but Coco Gauff defending her title, you know, in Auckland, beating Svitolina in the final, it was a very mature performance. There's a higher level to go. We want to see how she matches up against Iga this year, which has been a problem for her and many others. But very professional approach, did what she had to do, and hoist the trophy yet again.
100%. I think that this is going to be another banner year for Coco Gauff. Now that she's got the Grand Slam title, I think the most important component for me is, you know, you think about when she brought Brad Gilbert on mid-year, how good her results have been. We know Brad is, you know, a fantastic tactician. So I have a feeling what they did in the offseason was they probably sat down and said, all right, let's look at our game. Let's look at Iga's game.
Yeah.
Let's look at Zabalenka's game. Let's look at Rybakina's game. Let's look at Pegula's game.
Yeah.
What do we need to do? What do we need to get better? What do we need to minimize weakness-wise? And then let's go out and attack. So that's what I'm going to be curious, because I feel that this was probably a different offseason for Coco Gauff, where, you know, you got people like Brad in their ear, talking slightly different. Rather than just working on your game, let's work on how your game can really impress upon your rivals. And that's the big key. And that's what I'm curious to see.
She looks fitter too, doesn't she? Like, I feel like she put the work in, right?
That's scary because I'm not sure there's anyone that moves better than Coco Gauff.
It's the Lindsay Davenport through Andy Roddick that eye test comment. Like, yeah. It looks like she put the work in and it's scary. I wanted to, you know, before we wrap this up, talk about some players on both tours that have made some pushes and are approaching the rankings. Two more top teners to talk about. On the women's side, Shalane Ostapenko. There's nothing like watching a Elena Ostapenko, or in your case, calling a Elena Ostapenko match. But back in the top 10, and much like Grigor Dimitrov, best tennis in about 6 or 7 years. So it has been an adventure, but she steadily rose up the rankings, now in the top 10.
Yeah, good time to talk about it. I'm actually going to call her match later today against Marta Kostyuk. So there's going to be some fireworks in that one. Yeah. But, you know, one thing, once again, it's the same thing, right? Ostapenko's a Grand Slam champion. She knows what it takes. So now as she gets more consistency, as she realizes how to use her game a little bit better, she's another player. She's got weapons. She's got firepower. Yeah. So she is one to watch because you know that she has the mindset. And she's the one that I have the belief later in tournaments against some of these big players.
Yeah, you might have to put a helmet on, too. I know Vika said that helmet when you play her, and it you have to have that renewed focus because she's not going to give you anything and there's going to be drama. For the male side, Alex Demonar, top 10, first Aussie since, I believe, Leighton Hewitt to get to that top 10 ranking. So props to him. He is somebody that has been working and been stuck right at that cusp for so long. So it's good to see it, the win over Novak, but what do you think has kind of pushed him and given him that final nudge into top 10 land?
Well, I think Alex Demonar is phenomenal. You know, since we first saw him, you know, burst on the scene, obviously you felt like Leighton Hewitt 2.0, right? Yeah. Quick, feisty, gives it everything he has. One thing you know about Alex, he works extremely hard, right? He's going to give 110%. Big result for him, right? He even talked about it, been working a really long time. And as you know, for most players, that's a huge goal to get top 10. So, you know, that's good. When you get that validation, sometimes it can free you up. And I think for Alex, you know, going into Australia, that'll really give him a big boost. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about speed with Coco Gauff. He's on the short list for me on the men's side. That guy's first step and his quickness is insane. So you got to be ready to play when you play that Aussie.
Demon is a very appropriate nickname for him,
yeah,
for how he plays and what it's like to probably face him. Last notes on kind of the lead-up tournaments and whatnot. The Americans that we're seeing, I think Korda's up. I don't think that match is final. I'm going to take a quick gander. It's still going on with O'Connell. You have Ben Shelton winning last night after dropping his opening match last week in the tournament, and then Tommy Paul winning. So these are three of the premier Americans along with Taylor Fritz. But what's something to expect and something that these Americans can show you to propel them for success in Australia?
Yeah, I think, you know, fascinating times, right, for the U.S. men. Obviously, a couple of breakthroughs last year started with Shelton, quarterfinals of the Australian, backed it up at the U.S. Open. You know, it's tough to go far from Ben Shelton. I mean, the weapon that he has on serve, you know, it just doesn't come around every day. That's pretty special.
Yeah.
You know, chance for him to take this offseason and try to reflect and see what he needs to get better at. I predict, you know, it's not easy to back up those type of results, but I think he's going to have a monster year. I mean, you know, there's serious talk of, you know, whether he can make the top 10, which would be pretty incredible if you think. I mean, already his rise is quite meteoric.
Yeah.
And then, you know, guys like Tommy Paul, obviously another hard worker, right? He's totally transformed his career. Yeah. A guy in the offseason that's putting in the yards. Doesn't quite have the weaponry that Shelton does, but once again, one of the better movers on tour.
Yeah.
No weaknesses. You know, another year under his belt, so he's got a really good shot. You know, I think it'll be an interesting year for Francis as well because his expectations will have changed coming into this year. Right, he's been knocking on the door, getting late in majors. I'm sure he's shifting his goals to, like, I want more.
Yeah.
And with that comes a little bit of pressure. Taylor Fritz, of course, always got the big weapons. You know, I mean, we talk about it every year. Is this the year that an American man breaks through and lifts a Grand Slam trophy? And I don't think I would be stunned. I mean, there's a lot of good options there.
Now, with those five, you know, Eubanks even as a six there's a lot of options. And
I forgot to even mention Sebi Korda, right,
who
in the offseason, 5 weeks at IMG, trained really hard with Jez Green. Jez said, He's 20% stronger. You know, so these are the strides that players have to make from a young age, and these guys are doing it.
If Cordis stays healthy, last year in Australia, it was fine until that last match against Hatchinoff where he had the wrist issues. But he's someone, and that win over Sonego last night showed a lot of grit that he was able to fend off set points. And, you know, you were on the call for that one. Shelton is fascinating, too, because he's getting better. It's like the AI computer robot that's getting better. But you watch somebody playing against him on their serve, and they feel the pressure. It's like, oh, 15-30. I can't get broke here. If I get broke here, it's going to be lights out on the other end.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was calling the match yesterday with Jan Michael Gamble, and he actually had a very interesting comment because he's like, I get the feeling that Shelton is a little bit like Pistol Pete, Pete Sampras, right? You feel that type of pressure that you know you're never going to break him.
Yeah.
Pete would wait till 4-all,
6-5,
3-all, 5-all, 30-all to play his best tennis. He had the ability to turn it on, and before you knew it, you were shaking hands. You lost, right? And you didn't know really how it happened. And, you know, I think Shelton has that type of ability because he can play a couple of games where he's maybe a little inconsistent, and then all of a sudden he can play really solid games. And, you know, the thing especially that you love about Shelton is he's a big game player, right? You can't teach that, right? And I obviously, you know about his father was a really good player on tour. Played college tennis at Florida, used to the pressure atmosphere, but man, he loves the spotlight, and that's a good thing. When you get to the quarters, semis, finals, and majors, those are big moments.
Very valuable. It's going to be a fun time for American men's tennis in 2024. Wrapping up with Mark Knowles here on Tennis Channel Inside, and a couple of quick hitters, one being props to another member of the Tennis Channel family, Taylor Townsend, proving that you always got to be ready to play, right? You never know when your number could be called. We're in that pool, so props to her. I wanted to ask you, though, Mark, as someone that's been in these meeting rooms and been in the discussions, the decision by the ATP and WTA together to kind of put the kibosh on these super long late-night matches seems like it's a step in the right direction, and it's kind of a good sign that the two tours are, dare I say, working together here.
Yeah, definitely. As you know, I'm a player board rep on the ATP side. So, you know, there's been a lot of collaboration with the WTA. And, you know, listen, first and foremost, we want to protect the players. And you know, sometimes it's an outlier. Obviously, a couple of matches go really long. We had it again last year in Paris at the Masters. A couple, you know, went till 2 a.m. And so, we got to protect the players, right? Mm-hmm. We understand the entertainment side from the tournament side as far as, you know, delivering to their fans. But we also got to make sure that players have an ability to rest and recuperate and recover. You know, we had an unfortunate situation last year where, you know, Sinner had to make the decision to withdraw based on a late finish. And, you know, it's one of the top players.
Yeah.
Obviously, heading into the World Tour Finals, he needed to be healthy. So they're the right measures. And I think it'll go a long way. I mean, I'm sure you still have, you know, that's the tough thing about tennis. A match could go an hour. It could go even a 2-out-of-3-set match these days. These guys are so good, so athletic. Matches can go 3 hours, 40 minutes, you know, and that can kind of throw scheduling off. But with some of these parameters in place, we should limit the late finishes.
Right, and it's a great step in the right direction. There is no guarantee. I think it's going to do wonders for the sport. But again, there's things that could happen. Unless one of the last times you're on the show about the no-ad scoring, maybe after
still
three
deuces. Still waiting for somebody to adopt it.
We'll get Chiz on that. We'll get Chiz on second serve to talk about it. Mark Knowles, this has been a blast. Got to say again, congrats. I know you dropped Graham Knowles, your son, off at Georgia Tech. Yeah. I asked Eubanks about it last year, and he said, no, I had nothing to do with it, but I don't know if I believe him. But has to be exciting. You got the GT shirt on right now, but the start of the college experience had a program on the rise. So again, congrats, and has to be a good time for the family.
Thanks. Yeah, man, super excited. And, you know, I'm glad it coincided with Chris Eubanks playing such great tennis, such a great ambassador, not only for the sport, but also for Georgia Tech. So I'm kind of in that Tech family now.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff. And I know the early enrollment means we've got spring ball coming up and an exciting time. But Mark Knowles, pleasure as always. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Good luck calling these matches. There's going to be some firecrackers for sure. But thanks for coming on Tennis Channel Inside In.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me, buddy.
Huge thanks to Mark Knowles. Always a pleasure. He's very generous with his time and always learns something when we talk tennis. So thanks to Mark Knowles. You can find him on the Tennis Channel airwaves covering all the big events leading up to the start of the Australian Open. Now it's time to talk to the one and only Coco Vandeweghe. She took the tour by storm during her 15-year pro career, reaching the top 10, winning the doubles U.S. Open title in 2018 with Ash Barty. Coco Vandeweghe, full of emotion, full of passion, representing the country for Team USA at the Billie Jean King Cup and the Olympics, as well as anyone. She sat down in the Inside In studios to discuss a lot of things, winding down her pro career, transitioning to commentary, why she's not shy to say what she wants to say, and why she feels like it's important to ask players pointed and informative questions, and some hobbies as well as she dives into her life off the court. Coco's got some thoughts on the state of the WTA that you're not going to want to miss either. Let's hear from Coco Vandeweghe now on Tennis Channel Inside In. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network 2024. Mitch Michaels here hosting the show in the Santa Monica studios, joined now by a returning guest. It's been a few years. I had to check my memory bank, but she recently completed a 15-year career, was a Grand Slam doubles champion, two major semifinals, top 10 ranking. Back on the show now as a TC family member, and I see that with the pin on her shirt, but it's Coco Vandeweghe. Coco, welcome back to the show.
Yes, the TC family makes sure that the pin is there and present. I have to remember to bring it each and every day, so that's probably the hardest part of the job.
It's like a blood oath, I think. If you don't bring the pin, it's bad things can happen, but I'm really pumped to talk to you. And the number one thing being, you know, the last time we talked, you know, was the podcast in the car, if you remember that one. So you were driving. We got a lot of positive feedback on that one. From a lot of people.
I did pull over and I was safe about it. Okay, yeah. Everyone.
Yeah, Chrissy Everett loved that, by the way. She was like, I can't believe she's doing this driving. It's awesome. But I bring that up too, because that was one of the, and I'm not just, you know, you don't need to be gassed up now on the retirement tour, but it was one of the better podcasts that I can remember doing. And I think that was because you were so unique in your answers. And we talked about that during it. Like, everybody has like their set prep and they do things and you ask questions and you kind of know what to expect. But 5 minutes in, I was like, okay, this is going different. It speaks to just how you were a unique force on tour for so long. And as you said, different than most of your contemporaries.
No, I definitely thought about all what I wanted to say to people, especially when I started to have more success on tour, and how I remember watching players be interviewed and wanting to find insight into their games, into what it was like to be a professional. And what they would say was just kind of blasé. It didn't really actually tell you anything that you would have to deal with or what you actually felt. So I tried to be as authentic as I could. And I mean, that's all I know how to be. And I think it hopefully is helpful to a lot of younger players or even parents that want to have their kids go the professional route.
Yeah. I mean, we both love tennis. You dedicated your life to it, but it is a fair critique that sometimes it is a little blasé at times. And it's good to hear people, you know, speak up, speak differently, and just share their opinion. There is the pushback, though, that happens. And I know you've dealt with it a little bit. We're seeing it. But did you ever have any hesitation at any time in your career, even now, as you're a commentator, with saying things that might ruffle some feathers?
No, I don't. Just because I think in the way I go about speaking about myself is one way. And that's all I had to do as a player. Now, as a analyst, you have to speak about other people. And I've always thought in the mind frame of listening back to my matches and hearing the greats commentate my matches, especially when the first couple times I was on Arthur Ashe Stadium and having the biggest moments of my life and how negative they were on my game. And I always thought to myself, well, what if this is the only time I'm ever on a big stadium like this or a big moment like this? And all I have to hear is, you know, she's not as good as the opponent she's playing. I definitely had my fair share of tough opponents out there playing Serena, playing Jelena Jankovic. But I always like to give the opportunity for every player. They work their butts off. I know that myself, that, you know, they're a good player in their own right. They might not be up to the same caliber as, you know, Serena Williams, but they're their own caliber of player. They have spent hours, they have dedicated, they have sacrificed. Yeah. They don't have a normal life that everyone else is so accustomed to. Right. So I try to be as nice and as genuine as I can, but also give feedback if, you know, I ever hear about it, because sure, I would have loved to have had, you know, a Chris Evert or Martina Navratilova tell me something about my game that maybe I could listen back on and give, you know, oh, okay, this is a good critique. I can go work on it. This is something that a great player who has won many championships tell me, you know, oh, okay, her forehand's a little weak or and she doesn't hit it that well. And this is how I would implement working on that.
You know, the tennis side of it too is part of that, I don't want to say issue, but if you're a top 40 basketball player, everybody knows who you are. And it's not just the money side of it, but you're in the mainframe and, you know, words get thrown around like journeyman or stuff like that, that doesn't tell the whole story. But I did find it interesting with your career too. The last time we talked, you mentioned winding it down, wanting to get a final push. What led you to the decision to call it quits, the U.S. Open honoring you, which we'll get to in a second, and then playing doubles with D.C. and San Diego? What led you to make that decision?
Well, I was able to give it one little push, and I was able to get a WTA title out of it, a 125. And, you know, that's a big accomplishment from where I was from my first injury being top 10 massively, just destroyed my foot, lost the ability to walk. So being able to relearn how to walk, how to run, how to then move on a tennis court was its own accomplishment. But then, you know, as stupidity goes, I blew off my finger and then I had to restart from there. And it was just, you know, one thing after another. And the unfortunate part about Father Time is it's undefeated. Mm-hmm. And I really was getting sick and tired of not being able to train the way that I knew I had to be back at top 10 or even to be inside top 50, maybe be seated at Grand Slams, because those are the big moments where you get bigger opportunities, where you're not facing a tough player right away in first, second round. And that's basically what my decision-making was, that it wasn't fun for me to go out and play these girls that maybe for my own ego, I thought I should beat, I could beat. And knowing that I didn't have the training ability behind it because I just physically couldn't do it anymore. So that was the main reason I decided to call it quits.
Yeah, I read that quote you said where you just lost the spark to kind of keep going and have fun in the training block, especially. And I would venture to say your background being around so many athletes, you kind of seen it maybe firsthand what it's like when you get to that point in your career where, you know, look, it's not going to last forever. When that spark is gone, it's pretty hard to get back.
No, I still see it. I mean, I've been with my mom. It's the holiday season, and she still complains. She was a two-time Olympian in swimming and in volleyball, and she still complains, oh, I've lost my muscles. I've lost my body. I'm like, you know, you do have four children, and you are at an older age. I'm not going to age shame her here because I might hear about it later, but it's constant. You always have that ego about yourself if you're a successful athlete, that of what you once were, of what you were as a 20-year-old, as at your peak, and what you were able to accomplish, not only on the court or in the gym, but just kind of the physical attributes you have and are so successful at.
Yeah, you use the word content to describe your career. I thought that was perfect. And it's a good way to sum up an athletic career because nobody is perfect. Like, there's always matches that could have been won, more to do. But content is, I put the work in. I had a 15-year career. There were some highs, some lows, but I gave it my all, and that's the best I could ask for.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I was able to do things that I could were only in my dreams. I was able to represent my country, and that was the biggest moment in my career. And the only thing I really wanted to do as an athlete before I even picked up tennis was I wanted to be an Olympian. And that was my biggest dream and biggest goal in my life. And I was able to compete in the Rio Olympics and then eventually win Billie Jean King Cup for my country, going undefeated for the year and also helping them get into the finals the following year, going undefeated as well. And it was just unfortunate that was the start of my foot injury, and I couldn't help them in the finals that year. But I can only ask for, you know, that I did all the work. I sacrificed as much as I could and definitely gave everything that I had in this day and age.
I think the first thing on your career, like, write-up is going to be the patriotism side of it. Is that fair to say, like, playing for Team USA in some capacity?
I mean, I would hope so. I think I was very successful at it, and I definitely championed a lot of girls to then play on the Billie Jean King Cup team. And I think it definitely helps knowing that one of the top Americans that were playing at the time, I mean, I was number three American at one point, and you know, I'm willing to sacrifice, you know, my season, my career to represent my country, and you know, you should too. And I definitely would talk to girls, and I still have talked to these girls afterwards to tell them how great it was, how big of an opportunity it is. And it's the most stressful moments of your career, but it's also the most fun. I mean, Ali Risk and I still talk about, you know, winning the first tie against Germany in Hawaii and I'm standing on the table, you know, a couple drinks in, and I'm just like, this is what top 20 looks like. And just, you know, all these stupid things that we end up doing and just creating bonds and friendships that just last forever.
Tough to get those real home and away moments in tennis too. And you know, the camaraderie that comes with that, you know, and the next generation of American girls. I mean, you've seen it, like the next wave coming up. We've already saw another Coco win the US Open. There's other players coming up, and that's kind of the progression that we see. Your generation, your era, still doing well, but there's another crop of girls coming right behind them.
No, it's constant. It's never ending. I mean, there's always someone chasing your tail out there. And, you know, it's great to see these young girls. I've been able to spend a bit of time with Caroline Dolahide. She stayed at my place a couple times, and seeing her progress. I've played doubles with a couple of the younger girls, Katie McNally, and just trying to get a vibe on them and get a beat on them, because, you know, I always wanted that when I first came out on tour, to have someone from the older generation come down and be like, okay, you know, this is how things are handled. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, who you need to know, who you need to be nice to, especially. And I never got that. I didn't really receive that. I only had the great opportunity of practicing with Lindsay a couple times. She tried to help me a bit, but I just wasn't quite at her caliber quickly enough to stay with it. 'Cause you know, she kind of went away towards the beginning part of my career, went into retirement, and had, you know, a very successful family life.
Yeah. Just one thing, Dolahide's moment was great to see, right? Having that run at Guadalajara last year where you were on site. But yeah, and who knows, it's probably not the end of your run with maybe working with the Billie Jean King Cup. I think you're going to have a nice post career, and you might be kind of on the other side of that, helping some of the development.
Hopefully I'll get a shot. I know Lindsay's going to do a great job championing these girls, because it was also a big moment for her to be able to get the BJK King cup job, and as captain. And I know it was such a big deal for her, and I've known her family for forever. My mom played beach volleyball with her mom, and Winky, her dad, was always a ref, and so our families have definitely been intertwined in many ways. And I just remember hearing her talk about, you know, playing for her country and what it meant, and her winning the gold medal, and how momentous it was. It was great. And hopefully I'll get a shot once Lindsay says, okay, I've had enough of dealing with all these girls, and hopefully I'll be able to take Team USA in a different way to the Billie Jean King Cup.
Yeah, there's plenty of time left in your post career, which is just starting. But I have to ask, the US Open, you had you retired, you know, officially there, played the other tournament. But what was that celebration like, being honored there? And I know I've talked to Shelby, and I've talked to a colleague, Jan Michael Gamble. They said it was fun, but they won't give me any details.
Well, as most people know, that I enjoy a good party. I enjoy a good celebration. Yeah. And I really love that I had so many friends and family be able to see me in two different moments. My New York side of my family and friends, and then my California family and friends in San Diego. But it was great. The USTA, I'm so thankful that they just allowed this moment for me to happen. It brought me to tears watching the montage that they created and on Arthur Ashe Stadium, and just watching all these career moments that I had. I you know, you forget at some point, like, oh wow, I can't believe I did this and had these moments. But we had fun, that's for sure. We popped a couple bottles and then went to Quality Italian and enjoyed ourselves there. Okay. And then I went to bed. I did not continue the celebration. I let my brother, you know, keep going.
Maturity now.
Yes. I'm getting old. I'm getting old, everybody. Before, I would have gone out and kept going. You know, you would see me in the club life.
was that, that's perfect. Was that decision to go to San Diego just kind of, you know, like you said, another opportunity, retiring in front of the California friends in a place where it was basically home for you for so long?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so lucky that San Diego tournament fell at the end of the year, and I was able to have the people that couldn't go to New York and watch me play there. Unfortunately, I would have loved to have played singles, but the tournament director had other ideas, so DC stepped up to the call, and we played doubles because we were supposed to play at the US Open, but we weren't sure we were going to get in, and so we made up for it got to the finals and definitely had a more of a celebration. That one okay. I stayed up for. I did not go to sleep.
Okay. Yeah, playing with DC, it seemed like it was a poetic ending. It just kind of felt right, you two, you playing with her as your last match.
It was funny because, you know, we weren't that close going into even U.S. Open or San Diego, but I gave a lot of the American girls a phone call saying, you know, this is going to be my last year and, you know, I want to just let you guys know. And DC was one of those phone calls. And honestly, it wasn't even about the tennis. Yeah. We were just having fun getting to know each other. And I was her practice partner for the week. And I was like, DC, I'm retired. You don't have to move me side to side. You know, two cross, one line. I don't need to do this anymore. I'll just stand in a corner. We'll do two-on-ones. But she's a trip. And we had a blast and just more the sideline commentary. If we were mic'd up, it would have been, you know, for sure cancellation. We were talking too much crap about our opponents.
I don't think we could have aired it, but maybe somewhere. More with Coco Vandeweghe here on Tennis Channel Inside. And, you know, now you've kind of transitioned seamlessly to the broadcast career. I know you did some stuff while you were playing, but was it always in the back of your mind that a career in commentary could be good? Because it seems like a natural fit given how outspoken you are.
Well, it's weird. I mean, the end of your career happens and then very quickly you are bored. And there's only so much golf I could play. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what am I going to do afterwards? And, you know, as my career was winding down, I had the opportunity to try it a couple times. It was, you know, on radio, but able to just kind of get my feet wet and see if I even liked it. Because who knows, we never get these opportunities to be able to be on the mic and have a different kind of thinking pattern. You know, I'm not watching this tennis match to see how I would play this person. I'm watching this tennis match to be able to dissect for maybe how they're constructing a point, how they're constructing, you know, throughout the whole match, you know, game plan A, game plan B, that sort of thing. Not so much as how I played was the ball's on my racket. This is how I'm going to implement my game style onto you and you better figure it out. So I wanted to see, first of all, if I enjoyed it. Second of all, if I was any good at it. And I'm not going to toot my own horn, that's for sure. That's just a recipe for disaster. But I seem to be getting some good feedback and, you know, learning as I go. I still stumble over my words. And everyone here at the Tennis Channel family has been absolutely fantastic to work with and very helpful. And, you know, I've been getting the definite, you know, tricks of the trade sometimes, but they're still keeping secrets from me. You know, I can't steal all Steve Wiseman's, you know, tricks. Otherwise, he'd be out of the job. I just kick him out of that middle chair.
You got to slowly, it's got to be a slow burn. But calm matches with Chanda, I think Chanda Rumi has gone pretty well. Having your personality showcased, but also there's a constant, you know, push pull with being an expert level, having played it, but also being able to relate it to people that are diehard fans, but don't have that expert knowledge. And it's what really, in my opinion, separates the greats from the good.
Well, that's always what I wanted to hear from commentators. Like I was touching on earlier is just, okay, what are these girls doing or guys doing that, you know, makes them so good? Why are their shots coming off the way that they are? And I try to, you know, describe that as much as possible because, you know, being a bigger hitter, I definitely have an idea of how I did it and how they move on court, how they definitely move their positions and angles and what their serve patterns are. And I'm very fortunate that I've played against most of these top players and definitely have my own thoughts of, okay, this pattern I always remember, you know, like last night, Carolina Pliskova, she loves that T serve and you just have to bank on it. I mean, if you're not just leaning that way, it's going to curl away from you. It's too fast to catch up. And, you know, just knowing that I have that knowledge because I've seen that serve go by me plenty of times. It's just, I think, helpful and being able to tell parents, okay, you know, if you have kids, make them play doubles and things like that, because I found that so helpful for my own game and my own maturity and in my tennis. And hopefully, you know, it keeps progressing and people still enjoy listening to my voice.
Yeah, so far so good. I don't want to toot your own horn too much.
But yes.
When you went down to Mexico with Steve for that lovely Cancun vacation with just perfect weather, did you enjoy the aspect of getting to interview the top players? Because you're there for the finals and these are the very best in the game players, you know, but being on the other side of those desk interviews, what was that experience like?
It was actually nerve-wracking. I had a really I'd never had that experience before. I mean, talking about tennis is easy for me because I've played it, I've done it, but to have questions that I think are interesting, and what I would think people at home find interesting is two different things. Yeah. But hopefully I definitely got some good feedback from the girls, and they loved coming back and talking, with Steve and I, and I just wanted to, cause I know silly questions that I got asked. I was like, man, I mean, this is like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Yeah. And it has no bearing on actually like how I won the match. Or so I try to keep it in that mind frame of like, okay, I'm not asking, you know, the boring question of like, okay, you know, you're looking good out there. Like, why was it good? And I always thought those questions were just kind of like, you know, that doesn't help people, especially when English is their second language, is to, you know, feed them into like where you want the answer to go. Yeah. And so it definitely, luckily, you know, I got a couple tries at it. Yeah. So I definitely evened out my questions and made it more fun, made it more personable, because so many of those girls have great personalities, mm-hmm. and it's just getting it out. And, you know, they're comfortable with me. They see me talk enough, you know, around the tour that they can go back and forth with a bit of banter if they're comfortable enough.
Yeah. It helps that they know you, you're in that sweet spot. I think it was when Opelka was here doing broadcasting, he said, this is like the sweet spot when you're still playing or recently removed, they know you, everybody kind of understands you and their guard goes down. I think we saw that with some of those interviews.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I, even for myself, when I was a player, I knew the people that I didn't really particularly enjoy talking to or didn't trust to be able to, you know, help me if I stumbled around, because when you're playing tennis, it's so focused on, you know, the high level of intensity that you have, and sometimes to take that down and tone it down is really hard, especially when you're trying to be relatable or likable, because at the end of the day, everyone wants to be liked. No one wants to be hated out there. And it's tough to explain to people who haven't done it, like, why am I so intense? Why am I so, you know, brash? Yeah. Why am I, you know, the way I am? And it's like, well, you know, I'm not a crazy person out here, but I
mean, you have friends out there too, which is the other part of it. But like, if you're looking at one of your matches in isolation, it's like, wow, this is the most intense person I mean, I've ever seen. But then you look at the list of friends and it's like, well, obviously there's something likable here.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you see the crazy Stan Wawrinka match against Bagdatis, and Bagdatis breaking all his rackets. Yeah. He's one of the nicest guys out there. But if you only got that snippet of him, you're going to think, my gosh, this guy is just a nut.
Just the game drives you mental. That's all there is to say. Before we wrap this up, I did want to get, before I forget, your thoughts on, we mentioned it before, about the Billie Jean King Cup. You know, Kathy Rinaldi's tenure comes to an end. I know she meant a lot to your career, and all these American girls seem to have loved what she meant. And I did have that video I watched where you guys surprised her a couple years ago for her birthday. I think that was your handiwork. But,
yes.
You know, it was a heck of a tenure for one of the most likable women in tennis.
Yes, I was lucky enough to play under a couple different captains. I was a junior hitting partner with Zena Garrison, and then got my Fed Cup career going thanks to Mary Jo Fernandez, and she was great for that moment in my career of being kind and patient with me. And Kathy came in, and I was already kind of established as a top 50 player, so I felt more comfortable in my own skin, obviously being older, and she didn't have to play the mom card so much as, you know, maybe Mary Jo did for me, because when I played for Mary Jo the first time, I was just 18, and I got thrown to the wolves. I played Italy in the finals and got whooped by Panetta and Schiavone in San Diego. And I was like, oh, this is the worst time ever. But she kept giving me another chance. And finally I stepped up for Mary Jo, and we re-qualified, beating Australia in Brisbane. And it was really fun. We forced a tequila shot on her, but we forced it on Christina McHale, and Christina did half because that was our first shot ever, and then Mary Jo cleaned it up for her.
That's fair.
But I mean, playing for Kathy was so fun, and she was, you know, so patient and great with me, because I was very much in a different mind frame. I was very selfish at that point in time in my career, because I wanted everyone to be at the same caliber, same expectation that mm-hmm. I had playing for my country. And that's very hard as a singular sport athlete mm-hmm. to be like, okay, everyone has to have the same determination that I do. And if you don't, I'm going to be harsh and not as friendly as I could be right. as a teammate. And Kathy helped me with that. I mean, I was lucky enough growing up playing on a lot of teams, so I knew how to be a good teammate, but just kind of calming me down, like, okay, you know, someone's tanking this practice. Like, it's not going to be the end of the world. And yeah. And also, you know, talking to me, hey, can you practice with Bethany? Because, you know, Bethany does a lot of different things in practice because she has to be ready for doubles uh-huh. at that point in time. So that takes a lot more balls at net. You have to do some reflex volleys with her and work on different things. And I didn't mind it. Whereas, you know, if you had someone that liked a particular type of practice, maybe like Lauren Davis, who liked to just rally more balls and play, I was like, yeah, that's fine. I'll take it on the chin and practice with Bethany, which ended up being one of my favorite practice partners. Right. But at the beginning, it's like, okay, learning these girls' mannerisms and learning who likes what. And Kathy did a fantastic job and, you know, definitely made me team leader and helped me work on that with all sorts of different types of personalities. I was very fortunate to have some of my best friends with me to do it with Allie Riss, Bethany, and Shelby for most of the ride. And definitely talking to Shelby, she took a couple losses and being like, you'll get one. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Talking with Allie, she was clutch a couple times. Came in sick in a Belarus, so she did nothing, but was a good cheerleader. Yeah. And but you know, it was so fun to play with all these girls and just winning with my best friends. There's nothing better.
Yeah, Shelby also mentioned in Belarus that was not the plan. The doubles tie for everything was just total improv.
No, I had no idea who I was playing with. That's the craziest part. So I win my first singles, and Sloan is playing the second singles to clinch it, and she ends up, you know, serving for it. I don't know. I don't remember if she had any match points or not.
Was that Sabalenka?
Yes.
17 or 18-year-old Sabalenka?
Yeah. Yeah. So I beat Sabalenka the first day. Then I won my first match the next day, and I was like, okay, yes, Sloane's going to put me on vacation. You know, the champagne's on ice. Let's go. And unfortunately, Sloane lost, and I was expecting to play with Sloane, because that's kind of what we had been practicing all week. Yes, we'd mixed matched, and I'd played with Allie. I've played a couple points with Shelby, and it was I really went into the locker room, and I was furious in the locker room because I was like, dang it, I wanted to be on vacation. Now I got to restring all these rackets and regrip them and, you know, put my socks and put my ankles back on. The ankle braces were a pain in the butt, and you know, Shelby and I go out there, and I before we went out there, I went up to her, and because she kind of left me alone, she knows me pretty well, and I was warming up, and I went up to her and I said, Shelby, honestly, there's no one I'd rather be out there with. Like, we're gonna do this, and we went out and won in straights, and it was a great celebration afterwards. We had Jenny Brady with us celebrating. We were the party car. We were gifted some cognac and vodka from the Belarus team, and it was definitely put down.
All right. Well, that's the name of the game. Well, you had a great tenure on the Billie Jean King Cup, and I do, before I forget, it was one of the ties where you played doubles with BMS, and I know for a fact it was the only time the phrase Thunder Down Under was mentioned on our broadcast. So congrats to that as well.
I don't know if it's congrats to for me going and being forced into the Thunder from Down Under, but that was a fun trip for my birthday. But I mean, Bethany was such a leader for me on the doubles court for so many ties and so many events, and she was my doubles partner for the Olympics, and she was definitely a great stepping stone to be able to show me how to lead someone on the doubles court, because for so many years I'd play with so many great doubles players already. I mean, I'd play with Annalena Groenfeld, I played with Martina Hingis, who are established players and established doubles players at that point in time in their careers. So I was a singles player learning how to play doubles, and Bethany, as well as along with those two girls, helped me, you know, teach me where to stand, where to move, how to go, that sort of thing. You know, it definitely helps to skip a couple steps to have someone right there teaching you and telling you. And I mean, there's no one better that can match my energy than Bethany. Like, our high fives, I mean, We're shocked that we didn't break any hands out there.
Yeah, it was pretty aggressive, but it worked. Wrapping up here with Coco Vandeweghe on Tennis Channel Inside. And well, have to ask you thoughts as now an established broadcaster on, you know, women's tennis going into 2024, down under, so many tournaments. And it seems like the depth of the game at the top is as strong as ever.
The four box at Tennis Channel is killing me. There's too many matches going on. Yeah. But I keep telling the producers, Panda, I'm like, Panda, if you do another four box, man, I'm going to die. I can't keep track of that. Two box, I can keep track. Four is just too many. I leave the four box to Chanda to be able to decipher. But I think the state of women's tennis is going to be really exciting this year. I mean, we all know that Iga is going to be solid. We've seen that in our first couple matches.
Oh, yeah.
That she is just absolutely relentless. And that's a key thing to being a champion. I mean, we saw that for so many years with Serena, of just the matches that she would put forth was just beat down after beat down, not like, you know, three sets here, you know, a 7-6 set there. And hopefully, you know, we're going to see a couple more matches from Sabalenka to see how she's doing, if she can take that kind of relaxed attitude of forgiving herself like she was in the last year, got the monkey off her back with the Grand Slam. And then, of course, there's Coco Gauff and Jess Pegula that have been knocking on the door of kind of dethroning those two big guns at the top of the game. And hopefully, you know, we'll see a lot of back and forth battles. I think that's my favorite type of tennis, is not just, you know, the consistent winner each and every week, but the, you know, the multitude of people that can win at tournaments, and how many people, you know, the semifinal battles that we're going to see, or quarterfinal battles. Is, I think that's the most exciting points of women's tennis.
The stylistic matchups are great. There's a lot of variety. It's like, it's like a buffet. There's a lot of different styles for different people. You know, and quickly on Coco, she definitely looks like she put the work in her short and off season. I was watching her play. It's like, okay, this is someone serious about it. Pegula is right there. I mean, her season last year, as consistent as anyone. Can she make that next step and break through at majors? I would also add to your list, because Iga clearly being the top dog, I would look out for Rybakina now. Last year was disappointing by her now new standards, but she's another one that has the power that can compete and beat anyone, including Iga.
Yeah, I mean, she's always going to be up there, but I don't think she's as consistent as these other girls. Yeah. She's dealt with a lot more injuries, a lot more illnesses, and it doesn't seem like her body can handle the same stress as these other girls have been able to, and that can honestly be fixed with just managing your schedule better.
Right.
I mean, taking the at-home breaks instead of, you know, pushing through and playing two back-to-back clay court season matches or two back-to-back hard court, any part of the season. And it's just living and learning a little bit with that. Yeah. And obviously, after not getting any points at Wimbledon and finally establishing a decent top 10 ranking, and that definitely is, you're able to manage you know, your schedule a lot better being a top 10 player. And I think that call is going to be pretty good. I mean, she's going to be hard to beat. That's ball striking, the serve, it's really going to be tough. But I'm going to be interested to see if Coco's ability is going to withstand the time of the season. I know she's still young, and I think that's still, you know, a question mark. Mm-hmm. As much as she's already gotten her slam and has been, you know, a top 10 player for the last 2 years, it's still tough when you have those long seasons and making the year in championships and being unsuccessful as far as her terms of being a champion at the year-end championships, not being able to make the finals, not really playing that well. I understand, because I was there, the conditions, really hard to play well. But seeing how the changes that Brad has implemented in her game with the forehand, most importantly, the serve for me, because she just doesn't really have that consistent winning point off of her serve. Right, she has to really grind it out a lot in that. Mm-hmm. I know she's young, and thank God for youth, you don't want to be doing that for the long season that we have. You want to be able to finish points a lot quicker and not rely on her athleticism as much as she does.
Is there anybody else outside, maybe outside of the radar, you think could be crashing the party? Maybe, I mean, we saw Naomi's back. We've seen a lot of returning, you know, players to tour, or maybe a young player you think is one to watch this year?
Well, I think the couple matches we've seen from Naomi is going to be tough. She's going to be a tough customer to deal with. And she says she wants to play more tennis and more tournaments than she's ever played before. And if her level stays where it is and her ball striking is as big as it is, she's going to be a tough customer to play with. So I think she's definitely one to watch out there. But I think these four that we have mentioned with Iga, Rybakina, Sabalenka, and Coco, I think they're going to be holding the guard for most of these Grand Slams.
I can't wait to see how they match up in big matches, semifinals and finals, of course. Should be fun. Coco Vandeweghe, it's always been a pleasure. Two quick hitters for you before you go. One being, are you skiing again?
I got all the equipment. So that was my big Christmas. I got, you know, the ski outfit because I hate being cold. I got a helmet. I got some goggles. I got gloves. Okay. So I'm ready to rumble. I'm not ready to buy any boots or skis yet. I want to see where I fall in you know, the advanced or ski length. I mean, I'm down for any suggestions. Okay. That's for sure. But skiing is going to happen when I get back from Australia.
Kayla Schiffer, watch out. There's some skiers. Watch out. And the very last thing, I have to do a callback to the last time. Any sage advice you remember from your youth from Bill Walton?
Bill Walton would just steal all the quotes. I mean, perfect practice makes perfect play. I mean, he was just a running encyclopedia. I mean, I just love his book recommendations. He gives some really great book recommendations. What everyone says about Bill Walton is true. Yeah. I've stayed in the deadhead room at his house. It's wild. The drums that you saw in that documentary, been there, played on a lot of the drums. He's an awesome guy. And he was always so great to my grandfather. My grandfather and him were great pals, and my grandfather helped Bill a lot, and he would stop by at least once a month just to see my grandfather and check in on him. So Bill's a fantastic guy. I mean, just unbelievable.
Well, it's good to see, and it's good to hear. You know, you've had one of the more unique upbringings and professional lives as well. Coco Vandeweghe, thank you so much for joining the podcast. Congrats on the outstanding career, and then also just seamlessly transitioning into your post-career. Still a lot left. Maybe stick around at TC for a while, but of course, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thank you.
That's it for another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In. Thank you to Coco Vandeweghe. Thank you to Mark Knowles. And as always, thank you to everybody out there for listening to the podcast. And a reminder, as always, you can find Tennis Channel Inside In as a part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Go to tennis.com/podcast to find the entire catalog of outstanding shows. And if you want to find this podcast, it is available on all your favorite podcast platforms, whether you listen to podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeart, Google, to name a few. You can just search Tennis Channel Inside In and the podcast will pop right up. Please leave a rating, subscribe, leave a review. That helps grow the show. We're also available in video form on YouTube as well for a select portion of our interviews. Thank you again to everybody out there for listening to the show. We have a couple of days until the start of the Australian Open, Saturday night in the States, Sunday in Melbourne, an extra day of tennis, an extra day of delight for us tennis fans. We're going to have two episodes each week, bonus shows on Monday, each week of the Australian Open, double the pleasure, double the fun. So don't miss out on extra content on Tennis Channel Inside. And thank you to Coco Vandeweghe, and thank you to Mark Knowles for appearing as guests. My name is Mitch Michaels. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.